today on Against the Grain. He says black people are dominated not by the violent structure of the capitalist worker paradigm, but by the violent structure of the master-slave relation. What does Frank Wilderson III mean by that statement? What does he mean by the master-slave relation? I'm CS. You'll hear a set of provocations from the theorist, writer, and UC Irvine professor coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The question for today is, how do we properly situate black people in today's world? What is their position in relation to other people? And what is the nature of their vulnerability to violence? Those questions can be addressed in a number of ways. Conservatives, liberals, and radicals offer perspectives that perhaps you've heard over time. The answer offered by my guest today is singular and provocative, not least because he calls black people, all black people, slaves. But what does Frank Wilderson III mean by slave? Why does he argue that the master-slave relation cannot be analogized to the capitalist-worker relation? And what does he mean when he asserts that slavery is social death and that slaves, that is, blacks, are subject to gratuitous violence because their masters, that is, all non-blacks, need to exercise that violence in order to give their lives, their non-black lives, integrity and coherence? Frank Wilderson is a writer, professor of African American studies and drama at UC Irvine, and founder of what's called the Afro-Pessimism Movement. His books include Red, White, and Black, Cinema and the Structure of U.S. Antagonisms, and Incognegro, a memoir of exile and apartheid. Frank spent 5 years in South Africa as an elected official in the African National Congress during that country's transition from apartheid, and he was a member of the ANC's armed wing. When Frank Wilderson joined me recently in studio, I began by asking how important Marxism has been to his understanding of capitalism.
I think that when I began to study Marxism in college, I understood that here was a theory that took a kind of attitude towards the world that was uncompromising. And that was valuable to me, because before that, in junior high school and in high school, I had seen the kind of performative political labor of people in the Panthers and people in the Students for a Democratic Society. Part of that time was here. And I knew that these folks were on a mission that was more robust and more unflinching than the mission of certain types of Bobby Kennedy Democrats and members of the civil rights movement. When I actually began to study the theory, I understood why their performance was so much more unflinching than other people's performance. So I think the study of Marxism helped me get into thinking about relations of power, which I think is more important than simply thinking about the way power performs.
In other words, structures of power as opposed to how power tends to manifest itself in individual relations?
Yes, and I also mean that if you kind of turn your head sideways and listen to most Americans on the left talk about politics, what you're going to hear is that the rhetorical weighting of their discourse tends to be heavily weighted on discriminatory actions, the effects of unfair relations on people. And so what we really don't do so much in this country, and this is what I found to be very different when I started traveling the world, when I went to Italy and various places in South America and Africa, we're not as readily able to think about power as a structure. We tend to think about power as a performance, a series of discriminatory acts. And that, whether we're That's okay if you're a liberal humanist reformist. But if you're a revolutionary, that simply leads you down a track of increasing wages or getting more rights for women or ending racial discrimination. And you're finding yourself in the same kind of cycle of performative oppression 10, 20 years later without an analysis of why the fix that you had years ago doesn't last and isn't working now.
Well, the antagonism, according to the Marxists, is that between capitalist and worker. Would you agree that the essential antagonism in social relations, in political relations, is in fact between capitalist on the one side and worker on the other?
No, all of my work is interrogation of that assumptive logic. I'm sometimes misunderstood to be saying that I have left Marxism. I'm sometimes misunderstood to be saying that the map or the cognitive map that Marx gives us should be thrown out. That's not what I'm saying. How do you throw out a cognitive map that explains political economy so well? What I'm saying is that in Das Kapital, Volume 1, Marx has two opportunities to think the relation between the slave and everyone else. And each of those opportunities presents him with a kind of paradox, a conundrum. And so instead of meditating on that, he bounces off of that and continues to posit that the world is out of joint because there is a dichotomy between haves and have-nots, because there's a dichotomy between those who accumulate capital and those who work for a wage. And what I'm saying is that this is really his kind of hit on the slave and then bouncing off of that or disavowal of the nature of the slave relation is symptomatic of the problems in political organizing and political thought on the left. I'm saying that Das Kapital should be, the antagonism should be relegated to a conflict because there is an aspect of the thinking which presents itself with a coherent way out. And I go, and we can talk about this more later, but the slave, I think the slave non-slave or the black human relation presents us with a structural dynamic which cannot be reconciled and which does not have a coherent mode of redress.
All right, so if you see the master-slave relation as the essential antagonism, let's talk about that. So what do you mean here by the master and the slave? A lot of people would think, well, you know, slavery, okay, in the U.S., so black slavery, and then, you know, 1865, the formal end of slavery. But then, of course, you have slavery today, and we hear about issues with people in bondage, in debt bondage, and other forms of bondage. So when you say the master-slave relation, what are you specifically referring to?
There's no way that I can actually answer that in a kind of compact way. I think I have to step back a minute. So what Afro-pessimism, the conceptual lens or framework that myself and other people are working on, assumes is that you have to begin with an analysis of slavery that corrects the heretofore thinking about it. So the first thing that happens, and this is built upon the work of Orlando Patterson, his 1982 tome, Slavery and Social Death. The first thing that we have to do is screw our heads on backwards. In other words, to stop defining slavery through the experience of slaves. So that what happens normally is that people think of slavery as forced labor and people in chains. And what Orlando Patterson does is he says that what slavery really is social death. In other words, that social death defines the relation between the slave and all others, and that forced labor is an example of the experience that slaves might have. Not all slaves were forced to work. So if you then move by saying that slavery is social death, by definition, this is our foundational definition, what is social death? Social death has three constituent elements. One is gratuitous violence, which it means that the body of the slave is open to the violence of all others. Whether he or she receives that violence or not he or she exists in a state of structural or open vulnerability. This vulnerability is not contingent upon his or her transgressing some type of law, as in going on strike with the worker. The other point is that the slave is natally alienated, which is to say that the temporality of one's life that is manifest in filial and affilial relations, the capacity of families and the capacity to have associative relations, may exist very well in your head. You might say, I have a father, I have a mother. But in point of fact, the world does not recognize or incorporate your filial relations into its understanding of family. And the reason that the world can do this goes back to point number one, because you exist in a regime of violence which is gratuitous, open, and you are openly vulnerable to everyone else, not a regime of violence which is contingent upon you being a transgressed worker or a transgressing woman or someone like that. And the third is general dishonor, which is to say that you are dishonored in your very being. And I think that this is the nature of blackness with everyone else. You're dishonored prior to your performance of dishonored actions. So if this is it takes a long time to build this, but in a nutshell, that's it. And so if that thing, that's one of the moves of Afro-pessimism. If you take that move and then you take out property relations, someone who's owned by someone else, you take that out of the definition of slavery, and you take out forced labor, and you replace that with social death and those three constituent elements and a lot of other things, what you have is a continuum of slave-like or slavery subjugation that black people exist in. And 1865 is a blip on the screen. It is not a paradigmatic moment. It's an experiential moment, which is to say that the technology of enslavement simply morphs and shape shifts. It doesn't end with that.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Frank Wilderson joins me in our KPFA Berkeley studios. He's an award-winning writer, thinker, activist, filmmaker, and professor of African American studies and drama at UC Irvine. So if, as Orlando Patterson, who is a sociologist at Harvard, if he argues that forced labor is not a defining characteristic of slavery, if he says that naked violence is sort of one of the key elements, as you said, of social death, which is slavery, and if the violence directed at blacks is not based on, as you said, this person transgressing in some way, being disobedient in some way, refusing to consent in some way to what the ruling class thinks or does, then why is violence freely directed at blacks? What is the reason that the non-white or the master in the master-slave relation treats blacks violently?
The short answer is that violence against the slave is integral to the production of that psychic space called social life. So that the repetitive nature of violence against the slave does not have the same type of utility that violence against a post-colonial subject has. In other words, to, in the first instance, to secure and maintain the occupation of land. And it does not have the utility of violence against the working class, which would be to secure and maintain the extraction of surplus value and the wage. We have to think more libidinally and in a more robust fashion. This is where it becomes really, really controversial and really troubling for a lot of people. Because what Patterson is arguing and what people like myself and Professor Jarrett Sexton and Cydia Hartman at Columbia University have extended is to say that what we need to do is begin to think of violence not as having essentially the kind of political or economic utility that violence in other revolutionary paradigms have. Violence against the slave sustains a kind of psychic stability for all others who are not slaves.
So when you say that, and I've read some of your writings on this subject, it seems like you're suggesting that only if some population perceives another population as inferior or so degraded that anything can be done to them, unless they have that other in mind, that somehow psychologically and psychically they can't have the integrity that they want. Is that correct? And why would that be the case psychologically? Why would somebody need to have some other person seen in that light in order to feel actualized, in order to feel worthy of life?
It's a very good question, and we could spend another couple hours on it. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to give you kind of shorthand answers that have integrity, and hopefully your listeners will do some more reading and research to see actually how these mechanisms work. But let's take it for 1 second outside of the way in which I and other Afro-pessimists are theorizing it, which is to say that blackness cannot be, one of our claims, blackness cannot be disimbricated from slaveness. And that's a very controversial claim, because it's actually, that claim is actually the fault lines right now of African and black studies across the country, the claim that blackness and slaveness cannot be disimbricated, cannot be pulled apart. But I can't argue against everyone who disagrees with that right now. But let's just say that one of the points that Patterson makes at a large or higher scale of abstraction is that the concept of community and the concept of freedom and the concept of kind of communal and personal and interpersonal presence actually needs a conceptual antithesis. In other words, you can't think community without being able to register non-community. So his point is that because this book, Slavery and Social Death, goes back thousands of years, and it thinks of slavery in China and all over the world. And it says that communal coherence has a lot of positive attributes. This is my language. This is how I organize my polity. These are the anthropological accoutrements of how we work our customs. But at the end of the day, what it needs to know is what it is not. And so the idea of freedom and the idea of communal life and the idea of civic relations has to have a kind of point of attention which is absent of that or different than that. And this is the function that slavery presents or provides to coherence. So that prior to Columbus, for example, the Choctaw might have someone inside a Choctaw community who transgresses the codes of the community so fiercely that they're given a choice. And the choice at the moment of this kind of transgression, which is beyond the beyond, is between real death, we will kill you and stop breathing, like execution, or social death. Nothing changes in the mind of that person tomorrow, the day after he or she chooses social death. He or she still thinks that they have a cosmology, that they have intimate family relations. But the point that Patterson is making is that everything changes in the structure of that person's dynamic with the rest of the tribe. So that now that person is a slave, that person is socially dead. This is bad for that person, obviously. But what he is suggesting is that that type of action regenerates the knowledge of our existence for everyone else. Now, where I and some others take Patterson further is to say that blackness, and even the thing called Africa, cannot be disimbricated, cannot be pulled apart from that smaller scale process that he talks about with respect to Chinese communities or the Choctaw. In other words, that there was a global consensus that Africa is the location of sentient beings who are outside of global community, who are socially dead. And that global consensus begins with the Arabs in 625, and it's passed on to the Europeans in 1452. Prior to that global consensus, you can't think black. You can think Buganda, Ashanti, and Ndebele. You can think many different cultural identities, but blackness cannot be disimbricated from the global consensus that decides that here is a place which is emblematic of that moment that the Choctaw person is spun out from social life to social death. That's part of the foundation.
Frank Wilderson is his name. He's author of Incognegro, a memoir of exile and apartheid, and also of Red, White, and Black, Cinema and the Structure of U.S. Antagonisms. We have a link to his website as well as to his two books on our website, againstthegrain.org. My name is C.S. Song. Well, this is very provocative. Are you saying then that, let's just focus on the U.S., are you saying that every African American, regardless of income or wealth or status, can and should be understood in the figure of this slave who is socially dead in relation to the master who I presume is white?
Well, the master is everyone else. Whites and their junior partners, which are, for in my book, colored immigrants. It's just that colored immigrants exist in an intra-human status of degradation in relation to white people. They're degraded as humans, but they still exist paradigmatically in that position of the human. So, yes, I am saying that. Now, part of the reason is that in the short time that we have, one of the things that we are not doing is talking about the different ways in which different black people live their existence as slaves. Okay, I'm willing to do that. But what's interesting to me is the kind of anxiety that this theory elicits from people other than yourself. I mean, this is the calmest conversation that I've had on this subject. You know, I mean, you could say to someone that you are a professor at UC Berkeley, and there is a person in a sweatshop on the other side of the Rio Grande. This person in a sweatshop is working 16 hours a day, cannot go to the bathroom, dies on the job from lack of medical benefits, and you are a kind of labor aristocrat. And you could say, okay, well, that's interesting. And then you could say to that person, but if you read the work of Antonio Negri, the Italian communist, you come to understand that even though you live your life as a proletariat differently than a sweatshop laborer, you both stand in relation to capital in the same way at the level of structural paradigmatic arrangement. And that person would say, oh yeah, I get that. You say to someone that all blacks are slaves and that we're going to change the definition of slavery because the other things are not definitions, they're actually anecdotes, and your teacher in third grade told you that you don't use an anecdote to define something. And that person says, no, wait a minute. I know a person who's richer than me and also black, and they live in the Tenderloin, and it just goes off to the races. And you're like, it's a symptomatic response, primarily because they understand that what black people suffer is real and comprehensive, but there is actually no prescriptive rhetorical gesture which could actually write a sentence about how to redress that. And most Americans, most people in the world, are not willing to engage in a paradigm of oppression that does not offer some type of way out. But that is what we live with as black people every day.
Let me take us on what sounds like a bit of a detour, but I think it will help you clarify certain concepts that you're forwarding, and that is to go to Antonio Gramsci's work and to think about a word that he had a very specific definition of, which was hegemony. And of course, Gramsci, coming out of the Marxist tradition, was very interested in workers and capital and the conflict, the struggle between capitalists and workers, although he was interested in a lot of other things. What did Antonio Gramsci mean by the word hegemony?
Yes. In 1922, Antonio Gramsci was working for the Comintern. He asked Lenin the following question. He said, how did you create this successful revolution? And I can't get it off the ground in Italy. And Lenin said, well, there's no trough of civil society between our working class and the command modality of capital, the violent manifestations of the capitalist state. It's just, you know, we go on strike and the Cossacks come out. And then Gramsci began to theorize, okay, between working class suffering and state violence and state institutionality, there is this thing called civil society, which captivates the workers. In other words, induces a kind of spontaneous consent to the values of capital. Guild associations, schools, today it would be talk shows, okay? And not this talk show, of course. Right? And he began to theorize that what Lenin meant by hegemony, which was the domination of imperialist countries over countries that are trying to evolve into a kind of revolutionary dispensation, is different than what he means as he needs to develop as hegemony. So he has three constituent elements: influence, leadership, and consent. And by influence, leadership, and consent, he means the influence of the ruling class, not the influence of one person or another, the influence of a class, the leadership of its ideas, which is to say, like the idea of meritocracy, which is a very bad idea for a Marxist, and the consent of the working class to that influence and those ideas. And what he sought to do was to find ways to break the spontaneous consent to those ideas. Once he could break the spontaneous consent to those ideas, then the working class of a more Western, so-called developed country like Italy would be able to see what Marxists think of the antagonism between them and the ruling class. And then they would move from a passive revolution to a real revolution, which would be a violent overthrow of the state. The European Gramscians actually leave out the last part, the violent overthrow of the state, but that was his dream.
Okay, so then we have, on the one hand, we have force and we have consent. We have the force of the ruling class. We have the consent, which, as you're suggesting, if it is withheld, if it is abrogated to such an extreme degree, there might be revolution, there might be social and political revolution. But how does, in Antonio Gramsci's conception, how does hegemony normally work in terms of the relationship between force and consent in a nominally stable society?
When a state is stable in a capitalist dispensation, such as Canada, then there is an equilibrium between force and consent. In other words, one of the things that in a good, in the quotes for capitalists, in a good dispensation, what you have is a smooth situation in which for the hundreds of years that it took to develop capitalism, there was all this violence. Once people have been remolded from peasants and whatever else they were into workers, then in a capitalist dispensation, just as in a patriarchal dispensation, the violence goes into remission. That's what Gramsci means by the equilibrium. The violence goes into remission, and it only needs to rear its ugly head at those singular moments, which hopefully are not global for the capitalists, those singular moments when the working class refuses and transgresses the symbolic codes that it has consented to.
General strikes, mass aggression against the capitalist order.
Exactly.
Okay, so then this equilibrium between force and consent, which constitutes hegemony in Gramsci's mind, how does that notion apply or not in your mind to the relationship between master and slave?
Consent is never a constituent element of the slave relation. And if Marx had picked up on this, I mean, he says this in Capital, right? He says that he doesn't understand the slave exists in a state of pure force, but then he moves away from that. So why is that? Well, one of the things that Orlando Patterson points out is that what I just said, that any stratified society, by that he means, for example, a capitalist society, only comes into being through a kind of prehistory of violence, the violence that it takes to move from feudalism to capitalism. But once, the state of capitalism is set up, the violence goes into remission. But then he goes on to say that what's interesting about the slave estate is actually a phrase from the black feminist Hortense Spillers, but the slave relation, what's interesting about that is that the violent prehistory of the slave relation carries over and becomes the concurrent dynamic of the current history of slavery. And that is really, really profound. And you see that in, and I'm, what I'm, it's so profound that it's traumatic and painful, even for Black politicos and Black writers. And you see the pain of that coming through in slave narratives. In the film 12 Years a Slave, there is a lot of narrative energy put into making sense of how and why, of why Edwin Epps beats his concubine, Patsy, and why his wife wants him to beat her. So it kind of looks like sadism and ordinary sadism and jealousy on the wife's part. And so it actually becomes almost a kind of sick love triangle. All right, put the film away. Pick up the book. And what you find is that the violence against slaves in the book that became the movie actually has no utility. It has no rationale. It's like there's a, on the Mississippi River where these four, like between a place like Berkeley and San Jose, there are about 400 plantations. I know because my father's from that, one of those plantations. You have what's called, what I would call a bacchanal of pleasure, not a kind of utilitarian need to extract work or something or obedience out of people, number one. Number two, what you find is that the families on these plantations all participate in the regular beating of slaves, children, wives, husband. So it's not, there's, it's it sustains the psychic health of the people in the first ontological instance. In the second instance, it gets good sugarcane production out of them, and that could be even questioned.
His name is Frank Wilderson III, and he is a professor of African American Studies and Drama at UC Irvine. He spent 5 years in South Africa as an elected official in the African National Congress. During the country's transition from apartheid, he was a member of the ANC's armed wing. We'll take a short break and continue and speak more with Frank Wilderson. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Frank Wilderson is my guest in studio. He is author of Incognegro, a memoir of exile and apartheid, which won the American Book Award and also the Hurston Wright Legacy Award. And we are talking about his understanding of the master-slave relationship and the degree to which slavery is imbricated with Blackness, and also how Frank has both read Orlando Patterson's book, Slavery and Social Death, and taken it to, in a sense, a new level. So if, from what you were saying earlier, if you believe that the plight of Black people does not mirror the plight of the working class because of there's gratuitous as opposed to reasoned violence against Blacks, and that there is no consent really coming from Black people as there is when workers essentially buy into the capitalist order and kind of agree to offer their services in ways that make capitalists happy or at least satisfied. What about Indians? What about Native Americans? What do you say to those who say that the plight of Black people mirrors the treatment of Native Americans?
A lot of people have been genocided. So I'm not, you know, the middle 100 or 88 pages of my book, Red, White, and Black, first begins by honoring the destruction of Native Americans and what that has meant for white Americans. However, to make it really kind of simple and to pare it down, I do think that there is, in the main, which is to say primarily, there is a utility to the genocide of Native Americans that does not mirror the pre-logical, in quotes, rationale of the violence against blacks. Indians are genocided in the main for the occupation of Turtle Island, which is primarily why so much Native American theorization builds upon Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth and does not build upon Frantz Fanon's Black Skin, White Mask. In other words, so much theorization under what I call the meta-commentary called indigenism leads us back to thinking genocide as a mechanism for usurpation of cartography, of space. Violence against black people is a mechanism for the usurpation of subjectivity, of life, of being. It's great if you have a place to stay, but if you don't have a sense of your own identity, that's even worse. And I think that the repetitive violence against blacks, if we get back to social death, produces a regenerative form of being in everyone else.
So, in other words, settlers wanted Indian land. They killed Indians, in large part, fair to say, to get the land, whereas what non-blacks want from blacks is not land, but
being. If you look at the Dred Scott decision, there's a really interesting three or four paragraphs in this 250-page decision where Judge Taney says to the lower courts, "We are returning Dred Scott to slavery." One lower court had said Dred Scott made it to Minnesota, so he's not a slave. He made it to a free territory. The next court said, no, he never got released manumission from his master, so he is a slave. The Supreme Court returns Dred Scott to slavery and then does what is known as in jurisprudential logic as a Herculean opinion when it says to both courts, we are not siding with the court that returned him to slavery because he didn't get freedom from his master. We are trying to correct your thinking in this. In order for Dred Scott to appear before the bar, he had to become a jurisprudential subject. And Africa is a place of non-community. As a result, we're trying to teach you a lesson. There's no such thing as a jurisprudential subject that could come out of Africa. We're returning him to slavery not because he didn't get permission from his master, but because he had no standing before the bar. And then they go on to talk about Native Americans, and they say that Native Americans actually have political community. We recognize the arrangements of natality, affiliation, cartography. They have a degraded community in our eyes, and we're trying to help them evolve to become a superior community, but they actually have community, which is to say that the people on reservations are subjects worthy of jurisprudential adjudication. Return him to slavery, not because he didn't get permission to be freed, but because he's not a human being.
Well, let's engage in a thought experiment. And I'm thinking back to your claim about the master in the master-slave relation feeling like unless they dole out violence to blacks, they can have no psychic or psychological integrity or security. Let's posit that all blacks are wiped out. There is a genocide, and so all blacks are removed. In that case, in a sense, you are saying by implication that humanity would cease to exist because the conceptual coherence that it needs would be absent.
Exactly, and that will never happen. And we need to bring people like David Marriott from UC Santa Cruz and Jarrett Sexton from UC Irvine to think more psychoanalytically about this. But in a nutshell, the reason that would never happen is because, remember, utility. is not the same. The utility of violence against the slave is not the same as the utility of violence against the Indian, the post-colonial subject, the worker, or the woman. In Fanon's Black Skin, White Mass, he's negotiating between two dynamics. One is necrophilia. I just love black people. I love black music. I want to sleep with them. I want to be around them. And one is necrophobia. Yeah, you can come over to my crib, but don't bring your friends, you know? Okay, and so what he's saying is that the psychic arrangement of the collective unconscious is manifest with a push-pull in the collective unconscious between necrophilia and necrophobia. It's not important how that gets worked out. What's important is that that is a process of psychic integration, which is necessary for global community. And so one day there could be necrophobia in one psyche, and the next day there could be necrophilia. One community could be completely like teenage boys in the suburbs, completely necrophilic. Another community, like teenage boys in the deep south, could be completely necrophobic. The point is not that this gets worked out in a decisive way one way or the other, because that would make blacks like Indians, that they have something tangible to give up, or blacks like workers. The point is that it's there, that this is the push-pull of collective unconscious meditations. And in that push-pull, whether it's necrophilia or necrophobia, the concept that has to be reiterated is that the black is an implement. The black is an implement of that negotiation. If the black does not become an implement of that negotiation, then you have not a crisis, but an epistemological break, a catastrophe in the knowledge arrangement of the world. We would find ourselves on the cusp of a new world order, but one that cannot be predicted in the way that Marx does.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm CS, and joining me in studio is Frank Wilderson. He is a writer, critical theorist, filmmaker, and professor of African American Studies and Drama at UC Irvine. His books include Incognigro, which is a memoir, and also Red, White, and Black, Cinema and the Structure of U.S. Antagonisms. Let's talk more about sort of the black experience of social death. And I'm wondering specifically whether you feel that African Americans, let's say in this country, can in fact consciously acknowledge the violence, the structure of violence in which they operate, the structure of violence they encounter, I think you're saying, every day.
Well, we can articulate it, but normally when we're by ourselves. Because when we get into progressive communities, first of all, it's not even heard of. I used to work in banking for 8 years, and you can't even talk about this stuff here. But in progressive communities, there's a policing action that happens, which is to say, make your grammar of suffering, make your paradigmatic arrangement, your relationship to structural violence articulate with the other oppressed people in the room. And once that happens, we're trapped. I mean, we're surrounded by white supremacist militarization, the police, the military, but we're also surrounded by people of color consciousness, which polices our capacity to flower, to expand upon the theorization that I'm doing. Short anecdote, there was a conference years ago at UC Santa Cruz. At the end of the conference, Hunani K. Trask, the revolutionary from Hawaii, spoke, and then we were supposed to break away into groups. And the conference organizers said, you must go into a breakaway room based upon your color, in other words, how you are policed. And immediately, this is how the antagonism manifests itself symptomatically. Immediately, the black people were like, yes, now we get to be in a place where we could talk about how we are policed as blacks. But the people of color stalled by saying, there's no such thing as yellow. We're Koreans, we're Japanese, we're Chinese, we're Taiwanese. You know, we're not going to let you pigeonhole us into this position when we have our ethnic identities. The Latinos did the same thing. The Native Americans did the same thing. My wife, who's white, went to the white room, and they rejected the entire arrangement. They said, we're just going to talk about ourselves as Armenians, as women, as Jews. It was the black people who were energized by the prospect of leaving culture and identity by the wayside and having a conversation about how we fit into the gaze of the police. I think it was up to the other people to be authorized by that project and stop complaining about the fact that the exercise was putting them in a box that was positional and not cultural. But until that happens, there's no real political coalition building that's happening. What is happening, as Jarrett Sexton says, is that black people become the refugees in everyone else's political project.
Let me ask you a personal question you can, of course, refuse to answer. So your wife is white. Given what you are telling me about the position of blacks, what's your sense of whether she could truly ever understand your consciousness, your positioning within society? And if she can't, then what are the prospects of a relationship that could reach as deeply as, for example, two black people or two white together could?
Well, she can't. She tries, but what's interesting and important is that I would never put my marriage out there as a kind of example of what people could aspire to. As a kind of shorthand, I call her my wife, and she calls me her husband. But the reality is that I'm her slave. And that doesn't change because we have sentimental, as Saeed would say, contrapuntal emotions to the contrary. In fact, oftentimes those contrapuntal emotions are mechanisms or means of disavowing the true nature of the relation. Now, I would give her a lot of props for the past 8 years that she has actually inculcated this logic and did her best at that Santa Cruz conference that I talked about to tell the white people in that room, we're not here to think about how we think about ourselves. We're here to think about our complicity as whites with policing, not as women, not as gays, not as Armenians, not as Jews, but as white. On the other hand, if you read my book, Incognito, you'll see that in the first 8 years, there was nothing but resistance to that. And so that resistance is as traumatizing as the second 8 years are regenerative. And I would say that the first 8 years are what black people should take away from that. There's no way in hell we should have to go through the kind of resistance that white people and non-black people have to this particular logic, because they know it's the truth. They know that their anxiety, they know their own anxieties about the question, where is blackness? But they can't approach it because what it would mean is a kind of confrontation with people who are intimate to them that they don't know that they could withstand. And so the real question is, will these people do all they can to fall into the abyss of non-existence, not how they will perform as partial allies while keeping their cultural presence?
Why would a black person, why would you choose, intentionally, consciously choose to enter into, a life relationship in which you perceive yourself as the figure of the slave?
I don't think it's a fair question, because the question implies that knowing what I know, I can actually change my life in an essential way. The question actually takes us away from the problem that I've outlined, and it actually puts the responsibility of correcting the situation on me when it actually should be on you.
I hear that, and I think that prompts me to ask kind of the final thing that I want to bring up with you, which is, we hear a lot about groups and people who are victims, right? So there's this victimhood frame, and so these people have been victimized by, let's say, another group of people. And then the critique is that by doing so, you, in a sense, by focusing on that, by concentrating on that, you then deflect attention away from their subjectivity, from their agency, from what they can do about their circumstance. So Are you concerned that the master-slave relation, which is positioning blacks as foremost a victim in my mind, and that focusing only or mainly on a group status as victim tends to deny, and we're speaking here now about blacks, the kind of agency that I think you would admit at least they have some semblance of, and maybe some more than others based on their position in society?
I don't agree with that, and we don't have a lot of time to actually get into this, but the book Red, White, and Black is actually a critique of agency as a generic category. And what I'm saying is that, okay, so I'm not Elijah Muhammad. I don't believe that the white man is a devil and that this is all divine by God. I do believe that there is a way out, but I believe the way out is a kind of violence so magnificent and so comprehensive that it scares the hell out of even radical revolutionaries. So, in other words, the violence that black slave revolts, whether it be in the 21st century or the 19th century, has a trajectory of suggests could happen, is a violence against the generic categories of life, agency being one of them. That's what I meant by an epistemological catastrophe. Marx posits an epistemological crisis, which is to say, moving from one system of human arrangements and relations to another system of human relations and arrangements. What black people embody is the potential for a catastrophe of human arrangements writ large. And I think that there have been moments, I think the Black Liberation Army in the 1970s and 1980s is a prime example of how the political violence of the Black Liberation Army far outpaced the anti-capitalist and internationalist discourse that it had. And that's what scares people, is that, as Sadia Hartman says, a black revolution would make everyone freer than they actually want to be. A Marxist revolution blows the lid off of economic relations. A feminist revolution blows the lid off of patriarchal relations. A black revolution blows the lid off the unconscious and relations writ large.
I mean, I have to ask you, so then when you talk about this violence in maybe the ideal situation of a black revolution, what are we talking about concretely? Who or what is the violence directed against? I mean, are we talking about literally the elimination of the master threat physically?
Well, the short answer is that's for me to know and you to find out. And the long answer is that as a professor, I am uniquely unqualified to actually make that answer. I rely on providing analysis and then getting those marching orders from people in the streets.
Frank Wilderson III, he is an award-winning writer, activist, critical theorist. He's a professor of African American Studies and Drama at UC Irvine. He's author of Incognegro, a memoir of exile and apartheid, and also of Red, White, and Black: Cinema and the Structure of U.S. Antagonisms. We have links to him and his work on our website, againstthegrain.org. Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, C.S.
And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.